We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the life of Ulysses S. Grant. At the time of his death, Grant was the most famous person in America. Well, he certainly had his detractors. Most people considered him to be the equal of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. Yet today, Grant is rated by many among the worst of America's presidents, and some people even question the quality of his leadership during the Civil War. The question that we'll look at this morning is, why the dramatic decline in Grant's reputation? Our guest for the program is Joan Waugh. She's professor of history at the University of California at Los Angeles and has written several books about the Civil War. And she's the author of a newly published book. The title is U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth. And it's published by the UNC Press, University of North Carolina Press. It's out now and is available in bookstores, I'm sure, if you'd like to take a look at it. And as we talk this morning, of course, questions are welcome. We just asked callers to be brief and be on the topic. But comments are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call is 333-333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point, certainly you should feel welcome to pick up the telephone and join in the conversation. Professor Waugh, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, you're welcome. I'm delighted to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. Will you make the basic point right in the initial sections of the book that you think that today most people, most Americans, really have no idea how important Grant was in his own time, at the time that he was president and at the time that he died. And I was really struck by one of the details in the book, later in the book, where you're in the section where you're talking about the construction of his tomb, Grant's tomb in New York City, talking about the fact that at one time up until, I think if I have this right, up until 1916, Grant's tomb was the most visited monument in New York City. At one time, more people went to Grant's tomb than went to the Statue of Liberty.
Yes. And in fact, that conundrum, that puzzle, is what drew me to this book and to Grant as a topic, because I, too, even though an expert in 19th century history, American history, and the Civil War, did not know the extent of Grant's reputation and his eminence in 19th century history and for Americans of his generation. And so this book actually began as a question that I came across when I did research for my lectures at UCLA in Civil War history, that I was astonished at how much power he wielded, how long he commanded this huge position in American government and society, and yet how completely forgotten he is today. And the chapter on the building of his monument and the completion of it and the rapid fall from public memory of his reputation was, to me, it's a metaphor for his larger reputation and the way that it suffered a decline so rapidly in the 20th century and 21st century.
His reputation, the way that we think about Grant, could not help but be bound up with the way that we think about the Civil War. Is that part of what's happened? That is, the popular view of Grant has been shaped by the way over time people have thought about the war?
Absolutely. And I'm not arguing that Americans or historians have completely forgotten about Grant. Could never be true, because he was just too important for that to happen. But in popular memory, I think he's very much forgotten, and also in academic courses. And I think your point is extremely well taken, that Grant, and I think in general, military heroes are largely forgotten in our in our current culture. And I think it's because of the effect of World War I in the 1920s. Grant's reputation took a huge hit after the war because he represented, he came to represent the kind of warfare that Americans feared rather than celebrated anymore. And the fact is that the Union cause didn't seem so compelling generations after the United States was established. So it wasn't appreciated. What he did wasn't appreciated. And then I would argue in the 1960s, in general, the reputation of the military and the understanding of the role of the military has also declined. Mm-hmm. And so Grant is frankly not the great military hero that he was because people don't look at military heroes in the same way. And so it is Lincoln rather than Grant that has emerged as the great hero of the time and of the Civil War, along with Robert E. Lee.
I want to talk about some of the main events here in Grant's life, starting with his going to West Point, and he was quite young at the time. He was only 17 years old, and apparently it was not his idea to go. Later in his life, at the end of his life, when he wrote his memoirs, he wrote that at the time he had no interest in a military career. Who made the decision that he should go?
Now, I love the sentence that he came up with, a military life had no charms for me. The idea was his father, Jesse Grant, who was very ambitious for his oldest son from the time that he was a little boy and encouraged him and was very proud of him, even as the people in his town of Georgetown, Ohio, didn't feel the same way about Grant, his son. He was sure that Ulysses was going to have a wonderful future. And in those days, just about the best education you could get outside, I suppose, of Harvard and Princeton, what would be West Point Academy. And that was, it was open free for the male citizens of the country. It was a competition, of course, but it was an immense opportunity, and he wanted his son to have that.
Mm. He graduated he was not the worst of his class, but also not up at the top. He was kind of near the bottom. What important things do you think he learned at West Point?
Well, I think I do want to say that he was precisely in the middle of his class, but I think he learned to... going to West Point in itself and completing the education was a accomplishment that set him apart from all the other people at the time, except for a small handful. And he learned about he may not have excelled in the classroom, but he learned enough to graduate in the middle of his class. He also took advantage of the West Point Library and read many novels. He painted. He was quite a talented painter, and his drawings were very excellent. They're still on display, some of them, at the West Point Library. But I think he learned about the country as a whole, a national perspective, you might say. Mm. And I think this was very important, as well as making all the acquaintances of young men from all over the country. Very important.
Yeah. He went on to fight in the Mexican War. What do you think he learned from that experience?
From the Mexican War, I think he learned how to be a soldier. And even though he was definitely not supposed to be in battle during the Mexican War because he was assigned to quartermaster duties, which he loathed, he made himself available certain times during the war in battle and brought himself to the attention of his superiors for his bravery and was promoted. He was a captain when he left the war, a second lieutenant going in, a captain when he left. And I think he learned in the campaign serving under General Scott who captured New York City and under Zachary Taylor, he learned from those generals different styles, that he thought about and absorbed. General Scott, Winfield Scott, was formal, he was a much more reserved than Grant liked. He liked Zachary Taylor's more informal style, but both generals extremely successful in different ways and using different methods. So he took the best from both of them. And because we know that he did go on to be the top general of the Civil War, this kind of learning experience, both as a man, as a soldier, and as a future general, is very important. Hmm. And he accorded it great importance in his memoirs.
He, after the war ended, he remained in the Army for a couple of years, and then he resigned. This was after having been, I think, in the Army about 11 years. What led to his decision at that point to leave?
Well, the Army after the Mexican War was very different than it had been during the war. First of all, it was largely a peacetime Army, and then it was, and as such, it was downsized. And along with that downsize came a lot of frustrations for Grant. He was once again assigned to quartermaster duties, which he was very good at different places in Michigan and New York. And his, but it did allow his position in the Army allowed him to marry his wife, Julia. And in the first couple years he was in the Army, he was very happy. He had Julia with him. They had their first son. And then he was assigned to the West Coast. And that began an incredible journey for him, but a separation from Julia that led to years of loneliness and frustration that he could not afford to bring his family during the time he was in on the West Coast grew by Julia had another son. They had another son who he never met. And so he kept trying, as was the custom in those days, to earn extra money through business ventures. They all failed. He was assigned at the very end of his time in the Army to Fort Humboldt in California, an extremely isolated outpost. The commanding officer of that post didn't like Grant. And things came to a head, and perhaps he was drinking more than he should have, which made him no different than many men who were serving in the Army. We don't really know the full story of what happened, but we do know that he resigned, and he was happy to do so, and he came back home to Julia.
Let me ask you just more about that, because his experiences with alcohol, is because that's something you deal with at this point in the book very directly, and it is, I'm sure that his detractors use that, and I think, again, that in the popular imagination, that's one of the things that you think about Grant, that he was a really kind of scruffy, unelegant man with a cigar in one hand and a glass of whiskey in the other, and that he was an alcoholic. That at least that's what people seem to think.
Yes, I think perhaps he was an alcoholic. In those days, there wasn't the kind of confessional culture that is demanded of public figures today, and in which public figures often take advantage of, tell everything, and you get sympathy that way. So we don't really know what his thoughts were about it, but we do know, and it's documented, that accounts of his drinking were wildly exaggerated. And whatever it took to attack somebody during the Civil War in politics, that's what you use. So he was, I think in many ways, unfairly attacked on this, but it was just a part of the game that they played. Politics is a blood sport in this country, whether you were a rising general or a presidential candidate or the president. So that was just part of his persona that lingers most powerfully today. But it's clear, I mean, it's incomprehensible to me how people could still make the statements today that Grant was nothing more than a drunk, and that he was drunk all the time during the war and much of the time during the presidency. If you look at the evidence, it just doesn't warrant that. Now, alcoholism is a problem that he struggled with his whole life, I'm sure. So did Winston Churchill. But it's just, I don't think it should be allowed to cloud our judgment about what he did do, about his accomplishments. And I think the consensus right now, at least, is that Grant rarely drank and almost never when it counted, or never when it counted. There are some people now that, I mean, today we look at alcoholism as a disease. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. And yet there are some researchers who are now suggesting that alcoholism, like any other disease, can be differently experienced by different people. So what we see with Grant is maybe one example of that, in that he was not, he could go long periods of time controlling his drink or not being tempted at all.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Joan Waugh. She's professor of history at University of California at Los Angeles. She specializes in the Civil War and Reconstruction. She's the author of a number of books. Her most recent looks at the what has happened to the image of Grant, Ulysses S. Grant, over the years, from the point where, at the time that he died, he was probably the most famous American and very well admired by many, many Americans, to the point where today people consider him to be a lesser figure in American history, perhaps one of the worst presidents, dwelling on issues of scandal and corruption during the time that he was the president. Her book is U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth, and it's published by the University of North Carolina Press, and questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's go on to talk here for a little bit more about the period after his leaving the Army and before the beginning of the Civil War, because it sounds as if this was a difficult time for him. He tried his hand at farming and at various jobs with little success, and it seems that this is part of the conventional Grant narrative that we're used to, that in this intervening period, when he was not in the military, that essentially he failed at everything he tried, that basically the man was a failure. And then people go on, and then the next question they ask or they speculate is how is it that someone who failed at everything he tried to do was such a success as a general? And then maybe the next step from that is, well, maybe his success actually didn't have anything to do with him at all. Maybe it was something else. What do you make of all of that, and particularly how people think and talk about that part in Grant's life?
That's actually an excellent summation of how many people feel and how they felt, especially the Confederate historians, as they constructed his life and tried to explain his success. That his success, that here you have somebody who is nobody, right? He's nobody, he's a failure. And I suppose one thing when I started studying Grant's life that became apparent to me is that his failures have to be contextualized. And I think if you study American history, you know that the 1850s were a difficult time, that especially for farmers, and that there were depressions, there were challenges that Grant faced in terms of how to make a living in a very fluctuating economy. And so his failures were also the failures of many men at that time. And I wonder if I might say that he always provided for his family. He did feel humiliated, I think, when he failed as a farmer. He was not humiliated to be a farmer. He actually loved farming. He thought it was a noble profession, and he was good at it. His failures were the failures of, you could say, of the economy or bad luck, not of his own integrity or his work ability as a farmer. He's the only president who ever built his own house, a two-story log cabin, and he provided for his family. It wasn't the life that he wanted. It certainly wasn't the life that his father envisioned for him, and there was a lot of tension between Grant and his father, Jesse, during this time. But I would suggest another scenario and for explaining Grant success, and that is that failure can either make or break you. Failure is also a component of, or how you respond to failure is a component of character. And it seems to me that Grant surmounted his failures, and because of that, when the Civil War occurred, he was a much stronger person and could take the ups and downs, say, more than somebody who had always had success in their life, such as George B. McClellan.
Let's talk with a caller here, someone in Urbana on our line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So glad that the interview is taking place. Have you been up to Galena, Illinois?
I have. I've been there once.
And my knowledge of Grant, I guess, came after my visit many years ago. But at the same time, Grant's reputation first, you know, rose after the end of the Civil War, and then declined the reputation of his military opponent, Robert E. Lee, ascended.
Yes.
And I have heard other people interviewed saying that there were actually pro-Southern historians that were kind of directing the historical treatment of both men. Did you run into that?
Well, if you're speaking of the pro-Confederate historians who constructed...
And this stuff made its way, I think, into the school curriculum.
There's some kind of disturbance on the line, and I can't hear anything.
We can hear you just fine. Yeah, it seems to be a little bit of a hum on the line, but I can hear you just fine. Can you hear me? Okay.
Well, then I can just
yes. Go ahead.
If you're speaking of the group of Confederate partisans who, after the war, constructed what we call the Lost Cause version of Confederate history, in which the reason the South lost was because of overwhelming numbers and resources, had nothing to do with Grant's generalship or Lincoln's political skills. It had to do with the fact that the North just beat down the South. And at the same time it did that, it constructed a heroic image for Robert E. Lee, a heroic image, I might add, that was already very much there during the war. But Lee emerged from the school of history as the stainless, spotless, great, noble, gentlemanly warrior whose type of warfare was somehow different than Ulysses S. Grant. And I think that really, especially in the 1920s and 30s, the Lost Cause rose. Both it was present in academic histories as well as in popular culture. And some of its more notable manifestations, of course, come with the films Birth of a Nation and Gone with the Wind. So I think that has, you're absolutely right, that has a lot to do with the way Ulysses S. Grant, his reputation was configured in the 20th century.
There was a definite social class difference between these two men.
I'm really sorry, but if you can hear me, that's great, but I cannot hear anything.
Well, okay, then maybe, I tell you what, if you can hear me, why don't you hold on? Maybe the thing for us to do would try to put the call through again, and we will do that, and then we'll see if we can get back with our guest. Let me just then take the opportunity to reintroduce, and hopefully we can get hooked up again and get a good connection so she can hear us and we can hear her. We're talking here with Joan Waugh. She is professor of history at the University of California at Los Angeles. And her particular area of interest in history is 19th century America and the history of the Civil War and also Reconstruction and the Gilded Age. And she is the author of a number of books. And the one that we're talking about here this morning is about the life of Ulysses S. Grant. The title of her book is U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth, and it is published by the University of North Carolina Press. And in the book, she really starts out with this observation, as we've discussed, that at the time that he died, Grant was the most famous person in America. And there were a lot of people in the United States that thought that he was as important, as significant as George Washington and Abraham Lincoln. But that has really changed now. No one goes to his monuments. Hardly anybody goes to visit Grant's tomb, where he is, in fact, buried. His military reputation is, as a caller here has pointed out and as the guest has discussed, is really overshadowed by that of Robert E. Lee. And people, when they think about his presidency, no doubt think about corruption, political corruption, and the fact that people close to him tried to use their position to enrich themselves. So what she's exploring in the book is how it is this great reversal in his image has taken place. And I think what she would like to do is restore Grant to his rightful place once again. Well, we're going to go back here to the phone. And Professor Waugh?
Yes?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Very good. I'd like to go on here maybe and have you talk a little bit more about, I don't know if there's anything you would want to add to what we've said already about his conduct as a general. One can write an entire book, and a big one, I'm sure, about his generalship. Anything in particular that you would want to say about his military leadership?
I would like to remind people, if as I do in my book, that no other Northern general did what he did, and Abraham Lincoln knew that. He was the only Union general who captured three entire Confederate armies, and they surrendered to him at Fort Donelson in 1862, at Vicksburg in 1863, and, of course, at Appomattox in 1865. And as he demonstrated his ability to win battles, to capture territory, to vanquish the Western armies that he faced in 1862 and 1863, Lincoln realized that this Western man was going to be the person he would entrust the entire United States military force to. And I think that's important, and it's also important to realize how, despite the natural suspicions that Lincoln might have of Grant, the military hero, who was clearly more popular than Lincoln by the time of the Battle of Chattanooga in the fall of 1863, that these two men trusted each other. They came to a trust that is pretty much unprecedented, at least in the Civil War, at least if we look at Lincoln and his other generals. And so that both men had this almost frightening dedication to winning the war and saving the Union, no matter how high the cost went. And I just think that's really important. It's interesting to me to see how Lincoln has been remembered in his 200th birthday celebration this year. And what we see, I think, reflects the Lincoln we want to see, the Lincoln and maybe the Grant we want to see as well, the more humanitarian side, the emancipator, the person who grieved for the soldiers and yet the death of so many soldiers. And yet both of these men displayed this rock-hard resolve to see the war to the end and to reunite the Republic.
All right, let's talk with another caller, someone in the town of Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yes.
Hi.
How are you? A friend of mine told me a few years ago that Grant had a horse during the war, I guess, and he named the horse Jeff Davis.
He did. What do you think about that?
Is that true?
It is true.
Okay.
It was he had several horses.
Yeah.
His favorite horse was called Cincinnati.
Okay, and he had another horse called Cabro, I think?
Yes.
Yeah, but I thought that was...
he loved horses.
I thought that was really funny that he had the horse called Jeff Davis. That's all.
It's funny.
Okay.
Sense of humor.
Well, was that intended to be some personal insult to Mr. Davis?
Probably. It was. Believe me, there were lots of names for Grant and Lincoln in the South. I'm sure there were lots of mules named after them. I was interested to find out that Theodore Roosevelt, who was a great admirer of Grant, named his horse, the horse that he bought for his children, Grant.
Huh.
So maybe it's just it could be an insult. It could also just be kind of a funny thing.
Okay. And I guess just to make sure people know who we're talking about, Jefferson Davis was the president of the Confederacy.
Oh,
yes. Yes. For those who are maybe not completely up on their war history. Well, when the war ended and it came time to pick for the Republicans to pick a candidate for a president, this was in 1868, Grant apparently was the clear choice. He was at home. He was in Galena when he got the news that that he had won. And he went home. Apparently, the story is he went home and he said to his wife, "I am afraid I am elected."
Yes.
And you wonder that again would maybe either show humility or some reluctance or maybe a little of both. How did he feel about being the candidate for the presidency?
Well, I would like to backtrack just a tiny bit and remind people that it's not as preposterous as it's been made to sound that Grant was the candidate. He wasn't just a puppet. He had demonstrated a leadership role not only during the Civil War, but also in his 2 years with Johnson, in which he was the commanding general of the U.S. Army. So he had handled himself pretty good in terms of dealing with the political firestorms created by Johnson and then by the situation of the radical Republicans' opposition to Johnson's policy culminating in his trial for impeachment. So by the time of the convention, the Republican convention of 1868, yes, Grant was, I think in any normal period of time, would have been thought of as unconventional, not a professional politician, to be sure, voting for the first time in 1856 and then voting for Buchanan. But by the time that he was chosen, he had cast his lot with the Republican Party. He understood the great issues that were facing the country. And so, to speak to your statement, correct statement, that he felt deeply ambivalent about taking this position, about accepting the nomination. And if we can go by his own words, preserved in letters, we find that he hated the idea of going into politics, but he felt after having lived those incredible, tumultuous years after the assassination of Lincoln and then through Johnson's various debacles, that the very essence of the war was going to be, of the war's goals, were going to be denigrated by, as he called them, mere trading politicians. So he accepted the acclamation that came his way at the Chicago Convention of 1868 because he felt there was nothing else he could really do.
Mm. We, as I mentioned, I think today many people have this idea that he was a failed president. They talk about the failure of Reconstruction. They talk about corruption in his administration. Not that he profited personally, but that he failed to deal with corrupt people that were close to him. At the same time, you have to say that while he certainly had his detractors at the time, he was successful enough so that when he ran for re-election, he soundly beat Horace Greeley. So he was re-elected to a second term and continued to be, at the time of his completing his second term, was very, very, again, very highly regarded. Apparently, by a great many Americans. What can you say about his performance as chief executive?
That's a great question, and I think one that was answered so completely and fully by first the historians writing in the Lost Cause tradition in the late 19th and early 20th century, and then later generations of historians, I would say up to the 1960s, where he was a joke, an unmitigated failure, the general who didn't understand anything about politics and was manipulated by the party bosses at the time. Well, I think in any stereotype there are both truth and distortions, and I think the distortions are being a little bit cleared up because in the 1960s, the Reconstruction as a dark time, as an evil time in which radical Republicans held sway and Grant the militarists sent troops down to degrade the white southern states' attempt to come back into the Union. That's gone. That's been gone for 20 years, but what remains the same is Grant's low esteem. And the publication of the 31 volumes of the Papers of Ulysses S. Grant has a lot to do with historians coming around and looking at Grant in a more complicated manner, in a more contextualized manner. And what I mean by that, well, he was never, perhaps he'll never be a great president because he wasn't a great politician. And so he had no experience of being a party leader. His when he was first elected, the way he went about selecting his cabinet was astonishing to the Republicans in the party, who expected him to consult with them. He didn't consult with them at all. He went. He still perhaps thought he would do the same thing he had done so successfully as a general. So his cabinet choices seemed to be problematical. A lot of weak candidates were selected or without the party bosses okay. He made some excellent selections as well. But so he wasn't the normal politician, but he wasn't expected to be. He also made bad decisions. Historians have said that he delegated too much. He was loyal to his friends and then looked the other way if they were caught with their hand in the till. He should have fired a lot of more people in his administration than he did. But I wonder, of course, there are the corruption issues, the whiskey ring, the Credit Mobilier scandal, which actually wasn't on his watch, but the scandal was revealed on his watch, and other scandals as well. And I think we have to look at our presidents in a more mature way than we're used to. If we demand perfection, not one of our presidents will live up to that. The issue of corruption, well, it's always with us, isn't it? Mm. Have we learned anything today? Is there still corruption today? I think there has been. I think any president can be critiqued. But what Grant had was the ability to see the big picture. The big picture for him is that the time that he was living through was incredibly complicated in terms of reconstructing the nation. The white Southern population hated military reconstruction. They hated social and political reconstruction. The goals of the war, the reuniting of the states and also emancipation, proved very difficult to implement in the South, and perhaps it can be considered a weakness of the democratic system that citizens are often not willing to go the full nine yards to see a program through, to see reconstruction through. And so what you had during Grant's administration, which he tried to implement the 15th Amendment and protect black suffrage, protect black civil rights, find a place for African-American people in the South to live peacefully with whites. He tried by passing the Ku Klux Klan Act in 1871. He tried to use use military means, troops, to intervene in elections. This kind of interference, which was absolutely necessary to making the South the place that Northerners wanted it to be, a place that both accepted the reunion and also found a place for African Americans. It wasn't possible. And so we have to look at that and we have to weigh it and know that because one of the goals of the war was to reunite the country and get the Southern states back in their proper place in the Union, that meant Southerners could vote again. And in 1874, the Democrats captured Congress. And because they did that, Reconstruction was really over at that time.
Hmm. Something else that really strikes me, again, I think that this goes to the issue of just how highly regarded Grant was, in spite of all of that, how highly regarded he was in his time after he completed his second term and he went off on his world tour, came back, there apparently were significant numbers of people in the Republican Party that actually wanted him to run again.
It's true. He had a lot of support in the country, and it was interesting to me when I read his letters and also the accounts of his two-year trip around the world, how often he received letters from Republican politicians begging him to stay out of the country until just before the convention, because they were already plotting his return. And why would they do that? People weren't stupid back then. They knew that there was nobody more popular than Grant. But they also knew that if he came back too early, that his enemies in the press and in the Democratic Party, which were numerous and powerful, would diminish his regained luster, if you want to call it, that he had by this amazing tour around the world. And by the time he did come back too early, about a year too early, and so the attacks began. And the whole issue of a third term was extraordinarily controversial. And by the time that the convention occurred, his support was split, and he had the most votes going in. But then Garfield was able to emerge as a dark horse as a competition, and it's not clear how he felt about it. I mean, I think he actually didn't want to run again, but just was sort of swept up in it.
Yeah, this was 1880, and after that he would only live for about another 5 years.
Yes.
And right at the end of his life, it indeed was difficult. In 1884, he essentially went bankrupt because an investment firm that he had put most of his money in failed. And then it was only a few months after that he was diagnosed with throat cancer and told that he probably would only, he'd be lucky if he lived another year. And that is at the point where he writes his memoirs. And he apparently got an offer, not a very good offer, but an offer. And he was lucky that he had a friend named Samuel Clemens, Mr. Twain, who said, we'll publish it, and offered him a much, much better deal, which actually provided money for his family after he died. He did manage to finish the book, although he was very ill. And the thing, I guess, again, here I'm struck by is that it sold very well, and that was good for his wife and children. And by all accounts, it was quite a well-written book. What's your experience of the Grant memoir? I think we might have lost the guest. Okay, we'll try one more time here. We seem to have had our phone problems here this morning. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. And again, let me introduce our guest, Joan Waugh. She is a professor of history at University of California at Los Angeles, and her particular area of interest is the Civil War and Reconstruction. She's the author of a number of books, and her most recent is this book about Ulysses S. Grant. It's titled American Hero, American Myth. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press, and particularly looks at how it is that Grant has been thought about over time, and how it is that we go from having been so highly regarded and so admired in his time, not to say that he didn't have detractors and enemies, but he certainly was very well thought of in his time, and yet that has really changed very substantially. Okay, I think we have you back, Professor Waugh. Hello, Professor Waugh?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. My apologies for that. I'm not sure where the phone problems are coming in here. Thanks very much for hanging in. Anyway, I just right when we lost you, I was talking about his writing his memoirs, about the fact that the book, a lot of people bought the book, which was good for his family. And also, I was just asking about the quality of the writing. I think a lot of people say, as presidential memoirs go, it's a really very well-written book.
Yes. In fact, more than a lot of people have said that, have written in the reviews, in a variety of venues, have said that they're actually a masterpiece of literature as well as history. And so it's not as surprising as you might think if you go back through Grant's writings, his letters, his reports during the war, and some of his speeches, not all of his speeches, but mostly he's a very good writer. And I make the argument in my book, and my book is really a memory book. It's about how memory is constructed. Mm-hmm. And to me, Grant represents something. He represented something so to the people at that time, and that was the Union cause. And this was his chance in an era, in a decade, that the lost cause apologists were challenging the Union cause and challenging Grant's generalship and challenging Lincoln's eminence, that he saw as his opportunity to put down for posterity what exactly the war was all about.
And do you think that the people who bought the book bought it intending to read it and did read it? I mean, one wonders how many of those books were sold because they were veterans of the war, perhaps, or they were people who just admired General Grant, and so the idea of having a copy of his memoirs would be important, but they took that book and then they put it on the shelf and didn't read it.
Well, I'm sure there were people like that who bought the book because of that, and that's one of the frustrating things about when analyzing the influence of any piece of literature or history on the reading population, how many of them actually read it, what did it mean. But I'll tell you something, the veterans of the Northern veterans were very interested in reading it because they felt that they had a tie in this history. And if you follow the publication, the war publications, especially in the 1870s and 90s, you can't help but be struck by the many debates and arguments and that roiled the veterans. I mean, they voiced their disagreements in numerous places, at GAR meetings and other veterans meetings. So you do get a sense that it was eagerly, the memoirs were eagerly awaited, and perhaps the emotion, there was a great emotional feeling that swept over the country to see the dying general, know that this was his last word.
Yeah.
And so I think that while many people might have put it on their shelves untouched, many more probably read it.
We'll try to take a couple of calls here in the time that remains. Let's go to Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Sorry about your technical difficulties there. I guess I haven't heard it explicitly stated, but I think you're sort of implying that the reason that Grant was revised was because it was part of the betrayal of Reconstruction. Is that a fair summary?
I believe that Reconstruction was other than the war, which had the same kind of elements in Reconstruction, in that it was a corruption and a challenge, as well as idealism and courage. Reconstruction had all those same characteristics, and yet it has been singled out as the bad part of the war era, the unsuccessful part. And it's so firmly embedded in our popular culture. And so academics have revised history, the history of Reconstruction. But yes, I think that one of the things that has remained the same is that Grant's presidency was a failure and Reconstruction was a failure. And for students, many students find Reconstruction boring.
Well, it's a tragedy. I think maybe people don't want to look at it, I suppose, in my opinion. But recently the Department of History here had a colloquium with Robin Blackburn, who's mainly known as, I guess, in academic circle, a historian of Western world slavery. But he had a premise that labor issues in the post-Civil War era were extremely important as part of the background and the context. And it was actually called the Republican Revolutionary, the indirect correspondence between Lincoln and Karl Marx, who was a correspondent for a couple of papers while he was here, and there was sort of a curious indirect correspondence. And the working class, maybe suffering war always sort of accentuates people's ideas about what fairness and justice is. And there was also during Reconstruction, I think there was a betrayal of labor, and there was incredible amounts of labor repression in that particular period too. So I'll hang off. Thanks.
All right.
Well, I think that's an excellent comment, and it speaks to the complicated nature of the post-war years. It wasn't only about Reconstruction, which, by the way, had a lot to do with labor, that is, the transition of 4 million people from slave labor to some kind of free labor, however inadequate, but it also was a time of surging economic growth. And with that surging economic growth, a seemingly out-of-control economy that brought havoc to working people's lives, both over the long haul improved the standard of living, but in the 1870s and 80s and 90s brought enormous labor disturbances. America became a world economic power as America embraced industrialization, and early industrialization of the rise of big business, just created a lot of angst and turmoil. There's no doubt about it. But the key thing is to, labor has always been important, and certainly one could argue that the Civil War was on over the debate of free labor versus slave labor in the territories. And this kind of discussion and continued because the very heart of the American dream is, of course, economic improvement and how to achieve it.
There, we will have to stop because we're here at the end of the time. The book that we've been talking about, once again, is U.S. Grant, American Hero, American Myth, published by the University of North Carolina Press, by our guest, Joan Walsh. He's professor of history at the University of California at Los Angeles and has written widely on the history of the Civil War. Professor Walsh, thanks very much for talking with us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.